From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Alexis de Tocqueville, the great biographer of the American character, once wrote, "War almost always enlarges the mind of a people and raises their character." The War on Terror is a new kind of war, if it's war at all, but it has already engaged and been shaped by the American character. The instant 9/11 happened, or the instant it was framed as war, it joined a deep history of America's character being tested and revealed in armed conflict. To understand that history is to understand ourselves, how the American character rises to the battle cry, how we see ourselves and the world when the stakes are life and death. When Americans enter a war, they make it their own. Tonight, we examine the American character in wartime. What face of the national character is the War on Terror revealing? How will the War on Terror test and shape the American character? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll be joined in a moment by David Kennedy and Michael Sherry. But first, with us from the studios of WNYC in New York is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Good evening, Jack.
Good evening, Tom.
You've been roaming New York again today. What's the buzz in the city, Jack, on the eve of the anniversary of 9/11?
Well, I've been roving it, and I've also been looking through the tabloids, which have long takeout sections on the event that are extraordinary pieces of journalism and of reflection and of reproduction of photography. And if I may, I'll just give you a sort of our own little verbal collage of what's in these papers. Yeah. Well, here under the headline, "Still a Fresh Wound at WTC," is a photograph of a police officer, James Smith, with his hand on the shoulder of Patricia, who's 2 years old, and she is the daughter of Officer Maura Smith, who died on September 11th. She was, Maura Smith was the only woman police woman killed at the World Trade Center. And the photograph shows a rotund James Smith, the officer, who stands massively over her, the map of Ireland all over his face. And he has this benignant white-gloved hand on her shoulder, and she's holding the police medal given for her mother's death.
Men in blue. And
men
women.
Men in blue. And women in blue. And then here's a photograph, extraordinary photograph, of President Bush getting the word in Florida that the attack has just happened. And he is a noticeably less gray President Bush. And there's an extraordinary little dialogue here. He tells the he's trying to buck the kids up. He doesn't want to betray his emotions. So he says to them, "You're really good readers. This must be sixth graders." Of course, they're second graders.
And this just before he steps out to get the full news.
Yeah. And then the reading included the phrase "more to come." And Bush asked them, "What does that mean, more to come?" And the kid replied, "Something else is going to happen." And the president said, "That's exactly right." Here's a picture of a Marcy Borders, a temporary a secretary at one of the firms in the World Trade Center. Picture of her a year ago, covered with ash, her hands plaintively stretched out. She's been unemployed since. She can barely leave her house. She was a welfare recipient who'd struggled her way to respectability and a job, and now she's right back to ground zero, and her problems have resulted in the loss of her daughter. And one trouble after another. In fact, the paper noticed it says that that escaping the inferno was the last time she caught a break.
And the flavor of the New York papers, Jack, is it wonderment at how survival has gone on, or is it still anger looking back?
It's just sort of telling the stories of these people now and then. Policemen rescuing a woman. You see the policeman rescuing this pregnant woman, and then the legend says he went back into the building and died. You see businessmen covered with the grime of the bombing, and here they are beaming, smiling today. It's then and now. It's the city stricken and recovered.
There are more formal memorials of 9/11 that have opened in New York in the years since as well, Jack. I think you've seen some of those exhibits today.
Yes, yes, at the City Museum up on the West Side, an extraordinary assemblage of photographs and films. Really, they're in sort of three movements: the tower is beautiful, the tower is destroyed, and then the destruction transfigured in art. In the photographs of Jose Camila Vergara, You get a visual record of an artistic love affair with the World Trade Center over 30 years. Here are photographs that really bring out what I had never noticed, how beautiful this building was, how austerely beautiful it could be, the sun burnishing it, the white stripes showing on the side, the reflection of the river in the light, on and on, these great photographs of this viewscape. And then the last, after three rooms practically of glowing photographs, the last shot is of the light photographs coming up from the destroyed buildings after the
memorial of spotlights into the air, the blue beams.
And then two extraordinary films, one, the World Trade Center, the first 24 hours, that really brings home to me the Hiroshima-like quality of this. Here are those singed cars. Here are those, you know, accumulations of ash. Here are our streets, New York streets that look like dirt roads. Here are the fires, the cauldron, the dogs, the firemen. It's all there. And the only spoken word in the film that goes on for half an hour is a fireman at the end who suddenly stops walking over a rubble, and he looks and he says, "Hello," and there's no answer. And then finally, there's a sort of transfiguring of this in an extraordinary work of art called In the Light of Memory by Christopher Evans. And what he's done is he's taken snapshots, pieces of postcards, street maps, and made them into a collage of New York City in the shape of the globe, of the world. And right at the center of the world is the North Tower, seen from the South Tower. It's a gold obelisk. The sun is hitting it over a golden city, become a golden world. It's an extraordinary moment. And it's as if through art, all this is recreated, and through the magic of art, whisked away.
And taken into a golden world. But it's not a golden world yet. Jack Beatty, stand by. We're talking tonight about the American character in wartime, or the approximation of that we're living through right now. Our first guest tonight is David Kennedy, professor of history at Stanford University and Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, 1929 to 1945. Good evening and welcome, David Kennedy.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you. David Kennedy, we want to understand something about Americans in wartime, to understand something of ourselves today and how we're responding to everything that's happened in the last year. But I guess we can't duck the question right off the bat. Is this wartime? Does it qualify? Or is simply the framing of it as war by the president enough to bring up the American instincts, the American character that rises to that alarm?
Well, if it's a war, it's a war of a very different type, one that neither we nor any other society really has been compelled to wage. So I'm not sure that the war analogy really serves us very well. It's a state of mind that is associated with an attack, of course, the dramatic attack of last year that Jack Beatty has just been remembering for us. But the kind of sustained, all-out, deep mobilization of the economy, mobilization of masses of manpower and so on to fight a sustained conflict on the scale of the Civil War or World War I or World War II or even the Vietnam War, none of that really seems to be in the offing. It certainly hasn't been the fact of the matter for the last year.
And yet all the pedals of war are being pushed, and there's the promise of more with Iraq ahead. The framing, the political framing of this as war is well underway by this point. What does it mean to Americans when they're told they're at war? How has war shaped the American character historically?
Well, probably the single most important fact about America's relationship to war over the two-plus centuries of its existence is that with the conspicuous exception of the Civil War, and I would argue only the partial exception of World War II, we've never really had to fight major wars. We've had no enemies on our borders to fear. We've never had to maintain the kind of extensive military and naval and diplomatic establishment to keep our borders safe. The most novel element about the situation we've found ourselves in for the last year is that it's been a dramatic reminder of how interconnected we are with the rest of the globe, and how any lingering notion that our geographic position behind two great oceans could any longer shield us from harm is a completely obsolescent idea.
So the notion of war as something that happens at arm's length, apart from the Civil War and a bit of World War II, you're saying has been central to shaping Americans' character in wartime.
Well, that's right, and we've entered wars with an attitude that's been shaped by the long benefits of peace that we've enjoyed, and the assumption, most critically, that we as a nation have a kind of birthright to total and unqualified national security. There's no other modern people, I think, whose experience has allowed them to become so complacent and smug about the degree of security that they have a right to enjoy at a very low cost. But our historical experience shaped that idea. So we've been very reluctant to engage with the rest of the world historically, only done so really in the last half century or so. And when we do finally get dragged into the international arena, especially militarily, our tendency is to fight wars of a type that seek the total extinction of the adversary's capacity to make mischief. That's why we insisted on unconditional surrender in World War II, for example. And what we really seem to be seeking consistently is a restoration of that 19th century condition when we enjoyed free and absolute and virtually cost-free national security.
So there's that eternal, or we thought eternal, American idol of the untouched security. And I guess a kind of innocence, a state of innocence that comes with that. What sort of attitudes does that mean Americans approach war with?
Well, I think President Bush has, in fact, reflected this very attitude a year ago in his quite memorable address to Congress just several days after September 11th, when he said something to the effect that our goal is to seek the total extinction of terrorism everywhere on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that may be a wildly unrealistic goal, and it may be, in the longer run, some kind of political liability to hold that out as the rationale and the justification for whatever action we now choose to take or what the administration chooses to take. Mm-hmm. So I think his reflex there manifested how deeply this notion is built into our national character, that we expect that we ought to be able to live in a world where it is we're absolutely free from threat.
And by God, we're going to do it.
Yes, and whatever it costs. And mm-hmm. I think the goal is probably unrealistic at any price that we are willing to pay. I think we're probably going to have to learn to live in a world where we have something less than the degree of security we've enjoyed historically.
And when the switch is flipped in reality or in rhetoric from peace to war, what aspects of the complex American character does that pull to the fore?
Well, as I say, I think it sets off this reflex that we seek to restore this pristine condition of absolute unqualified security by any means necessary. There's a famous analogy that the diplomat and historian George Kennan once came up mm-hmm. with to describe this. He described American foreign policy as analogous to a dinosaur in the swamp that is impervious to its environment, it is absolutely oblivious to anything that's going on around it, until it gets whacked on the tail by some other member of the swamp community, and then it lashes about with such force and destructiveness that it lays waste to everything about it. And he said that's essentially a way to think about the history of American foreign policy. We're indifferent to the rest of the world for long periods of time. Then we're provoked, and then we react in a way that lays waste to the environment.
Jack Beatty, are we laying waste to the environment now or still in some kind of middle ground?
Well, and hello to David Kennedy. Much missed on this program. Well, we're waiting. I mean, the president, Secretary Rumsfeld, has said that we are going to reserve the right to intervene in countries, even if they don't want us to pluck out terrorists and conduct raids. We're on the verge of a war with Iraq, which, according to the New York Times today, there's no evidence that Saddam had anything to do with 9/11. We have adopted a doctrine of preemptive strikes, which President Kennedy rejected when we were threatened with nuclear annihilation in the Cuban Missile Crisis. So we're about, it seems to me, to be throwing a lot of weight around. We're on the verge of it, it appears, in that swamp. And we've discovered the world, it seems to me, only to sort of brush it away with all our alliances and friends in the world alienated.
It's not so far gone yet, though. Listeners, we're talking about the American character in wartime tonight. If it is wartime, what face of the American character is the war on terror revealing? How will the war on terror test and shape the American character? And how will the American character shape this war and our understanding of it? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
from Boston University. This is WBU.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the American character in wartime. And the question for you, listeners, is this: what face of the American character is the War on Terror revealing? How is our deep American character shaping our response to the terrorist threat? And how does that character interact with the ambiguities of this new conflict? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with David Kennedy, professor of history at Stanford University and author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Freedom from Fear. We're joined now from Interlochen, Michigan, by Michael Sherry. He's associate dean of history at Northwestern University and author of In the Shadow of War, the United States Since the 1930s. Good evening and welcome, Michael Sherry.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
It's good to have you with us. Michael Sherry, we've just heard from David Kennedy the view of the American character and war that says we are reluctant to go to war, but when we do, it's total victory that we require, that it's a kind of binary state and a line that we cross reluctantly. Is that the way you see the American character interacting with war?
Roughly, it's the way I see it. I think I would put it in slightly different and sharper terms as more of a contradiction in the American character. We see ourselves as a peace-loving nation, but in practice, particularly since 1941, we have gone to war or engaged in military action with quite astonishing frequency and extraordinary geographic range. So there's where I see an almost irresolvable tension for the American people and the American character.
The tension being that Americans see themselves as peace-loving, but in your view, in fact, are quick to war?
I didn't say they are quick to war. I say they are frequently engaged in war or military action, and you can explain or defend, even embrace that military action, each of those things. But the sheer frequency of it seems to contradict or at least be in tension with this notion that we are a peace-loving people.
And what about now, Michael Sherry? David Kennedy raised some question about whether, in fact, we are at war, despite the president's presentation of our current state as being at war. How would you see it? Have we cleared the hurdle? Are we at war? Or does it matter if the president frames it that way? Are we effectively there psychologically?
It matters very much whether he frames it that way. It matters in part just politically, as I think David suggested, because calling this a war, particularly the way that President Bush has called it a war, raises expectations that can easily come to haunt a president if he's unable to deliver on them. I don't think that it is a way of imagining current American policy and behavior that has quite yet resonated with most Americans, or at least if they grasp that notion that we're at war abstractly, they have very little sense of what that means beyond the abstraction. I've been struck by how much of the focus here on the first anniversary of 9/11, how much that focus has been backward-looking. It's been memorial in focus and tone. It's been about what happened in the past, not about where we go in the future.
And by the past, you mean on September 11th itself?
Yes. It's not, as one opinion writer noted today in the Times, it's not what you would have found on December 7th, 1942.
And the difference, you would imagine?
In December 7th, 1942, there was such a huge-scale war going on, and it was ever-growing in terms of the American role in it, that there really wasn't a great deal of time, energy, or perhaps political need to look backwards to December 7th, 1941. There was a sense of urgency about the enormity of the task that lay ahead. The urgency may still be there for many Americans, but the nature of the task is extraordinarily fuzzy.
And do you see when a president rolls out the W word, rolls out war, what is it traditionally, historically, that an American president is intending to summon from the American people, from the American character? And is that happening now?
He's attempting to summon political support for his own policies. He's attempting to summon a kind of collective energy or will by which the nation will pursue its war-making enterprise. But I think that invocation of war has in a way been overused or cheapened in American political life over recent decades, to the point that it makes it even harder now for Bush to invoke that term. He's not the first president to declare war on terrorism. Ronald Reagan did that. Mm-hmm. The notion of war on terrorism, on drugs, on AIDS, on cancer, on smoking, on illiteracy, poverty, blah, blah, blah. These things run deeply in recent American history. In fact, in a way, perhaps we have fallen as a nation into the habit of calling so many things a war that we have difficulty any longer knowing what that term means or knowing what it means when we are in a war.
David Kennedy, what about that? It seems that in part President Bush uses the framing of war to impose or encourage a kind of moral clarity. Is our national character fogging our view of this conflict or helping us see through to its core somehow?
Well, let me avoid the question for the moment of national character and come at it from a little different angle, mm-hmm. which is our historical experience, mm-hmm. which the sum of which is, after all, our national character.
Indeed.
But the I think it's worth emphasizing what Michael Sherry said about the depreciation of the meaning of the very term war in recent years. I think one could make a case that that there was this famous phrase about World War I, that it was the war to end war.
Mm-hmm.
One could, in fact, argue that World War II, in fact, ended war as it was historically known. And that is, war that called for the deep and extensive and pervasive mobilization of entire societies and the fielding of large military forces whose recruitment and training and deployment stressed and strained the fabric of the society at large. There hasn't been a war like that ever since. I mean, Korea wasn't like that. Vietnam wasn't like that. Certainly the interventions in Grenada and Panama and so on mm-hmm. didn't resemble that in the least, not to mention Kosovo and even the Gulf War. So it's perversely and oddly enough, it's become possible for a society like ours to wield enormous firepower and destructive capacity and to deploy it in any number of places around the world, for that matter, without really badly disrupting at least the material circumstances of life in this country.
And yet the threat that seemed to be revealed on 9/11, or by extension, what a terrorist threat could mean to this country, seemed to suggest terrible damage if some kind of strong countermeasures weren't taken. Isn't that at least half the equation of war, the threat of what's been described as even potential annihilation, or at least of whole metropolitan populations?
Well, mercifully, we haven't seen that yet. And for all the drama and the real and painful human tragedy mm-hmm. of September 11th, we need to remember that the death toll on that day was roughly comparable to the death toll on a single day at Normandy, in D-Day in 1944. It's but a tiny fraction of the people that died in the siege of Leningrad in World War II. It's a fraction of the people that died in a single instant at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So we haven't. It was dramatic and it was tragic and highly regrettable, to put it mildly. But so far at least, terrorists have not succeeded in inflicting the truly catastrophic kind of damage on this society that would really call its basic functioning into question, or that might result in the overthrow of the regime of government that we've enjoyed constitutionally for two centuries. There's nothing approaching that yet.
We're talking tonight about the American character in wartime with David Kennedy at Stanford University and Michael Sherry from Northwestern. You're welcome to join us at 1-800-423-8255. John is on the line. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, my question has to do with one thing that I think is missing from this discussion of war, mm-hmm. which is sacrifice, the notion of shared sacrifice. The president after 9/11 asked us to go shopping to fight the war on terrorism, and I haven't heard anything from higher taxes to a national energy security policy, even to the willingness to have a lot of troops go to Afghanistan and take high casualties, which I think the country would have supported. So I guess my question is a call to sacrifice missing from this?
Thanks for the question, John. Michael Sherry, what about the sacrificial element? You've noted that we're already memorializing the dead of 9/11 almost as if it's the war's end. But if this is being framed at war, how important is sacrifice or the call to sacrifice in picking up the resonance in American citizenry?
The dead of 9/11 are the sacrifice. They are the collective sacrifice, in a sense. And there may be no further great collective sacrifice either asked for or experienced. But if you're asking where that sense of sacrifice and war is located for Americans now, that's where it's located.
Is that enough?
I don't know, because no American war has that particular character of involving an enormous loss at the beginning, mm-hmm. and very little, if any, subsequently, if we're so lucky, in fact, to have very little loss from this point forward. I can't draw on history to imagine very well whether that will be enough. Much depends on political leadership and how that sacrifice is deployed and understood by national leaders. But your guess is as good as mine on that score.
Jack Beatty, I'm struck at the fog of war or otherwise that's here. The conflict is put in terms of good and evil, but as we walk into it with these historians who have watched and studied Americans through many wars, the ambiguities of this conflict are just glaring. There's death, there's shock, and there's an initial sacrifice, and then so much uncertainty about exactly what we are engaged in here.
Yes, and it's an ambiguity. The ambiguities of the war, though, haven't been represented in the president's representation of it. He's taken this complicated political, economic, civilizational clash, this aspect of it, and he's allegorized it. This is a conflict between good and evil. Now, of course, that we did see evil on September 11th, and Lord knows we saw good. I think of the line of Yeats's, "The ceremony of innocence is drowned in blood." Mm-hmm. But what happened then was the result of history. And I think this penchant that David and Michael have talked about of the getting back to the sort of status quo ante, the primal innocence that we've all lost back there in the 19th century, that innocence is really means out of history. It means in this sort of moral realm where we're the city on the hill, where we lead by example, where there's wicked Europe and good America, all the sort of antimonies of 19th century rhetoric about the old world and the new and the new American. You see it in our fiction. Henry James's character is Christopher Newman, the American. And this I think is very harmful to us, this allegorizing of war and taking the politics out of it, for example. And it's very convenient for our leaders. For example, here, obviously, our basing of forces forward in Saudi Arabia was one of the gave Mr. Bin Laden one of his causes. Not justifying it, that's the fact. And Mr. Bin Laden and others like him were trained, were whipped up, were armed by our CIA with a $10 billion subvention through the 1980s by Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle and other people who are now seeking to destroy the very forces they built up. All of that is blanched out with this talk of good and evil. Very convenient for the president.
David Kennedy, though, if we are trying, as a matter of character and instinct, to fight our way back to Eden, to the secure kind of paradise that you describe, what are the implications of that for the practical dynamics of this conflict, which is a real conflict, war or whatever?
Well, I think the implication, the first implication that strikes my mind is that getting to that goal by strictly military means is an exercise in futility. And it seems to me that there's another tradition that this country has nurtured and a tendency in history of where we've been in the forefront for the last half century, which has been largely ignored in the present crisis. That is that we took the lead after World War II in building a more interconnected and, I dare say, interdependent world. We godfathered and sustained institutions like the United Nations, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which became the World Trade Organization. so on and so forth. All of these build a tissue of interconnectedness in global civilization. Indeed, that is the institutional underpinning of the phenomenon that we have taken to calling globalization.
So there's no retreat.
Well, the present administration seems to think there is a retreat. It has tried to retreat, in fact, from things like the Kyoto Protocol and the International Criminal Court and so on and so forth to diminish the American role in the very institutions that the United States, in many cases, took the lead in founding and sustaining for the last two or three generations. I think if there's any reasonable, any strategy to deal with terrorism that has a reasonable prospect of success, it must be more than simply military in the application of force. It must be, this country must understand how interconnected the world is and work within those institutions and maybe even build some new institutions that tie the world, the interests of all the world's peoples together and make this kind of mentality obsolete.
Ivan is on the line. Welcome, Ivan. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
My initial reaction to the whole thing, besides being horror and disgust, was I was surprised at the negative reaction overall in regards to any kind of opinion of dissent. I was shocked more by the it was hard to be a dissenting voice in this country. It was hard to be someone in favor of liberal institutions.
After 9/11, you're saying, Ivan.
After 9/11. Mm-hmm. It was hard to be a foreigner. It is hard to. It seems almost that xenophobia, that subtle racism, all of that has come to the forefront very easily. And I think it has come back in the past in other instances.
Ivan, our time is short before the break. Let me get Michael Sherry to respond. Thanks for your call, Michael Sherry. Is this true to form, a kind of closing ranks, a kind of unity of view or a suppression, intolerance of dissent?
Well, it always happens to some degree in wartime. It's a suppression or a muffling, I think, would, in some ways is the better word, of dissent, that it is more curious in this instance because so little actual war making is going on. Mm-hmm. It's not the kind of atmosphere that one had in 1943 or even in 1967.
Might be a moment where more debate is helpful rather than less.
Right. I would point out that there is one obvious acceptable form of dissent that has been showing itself recently in American politics. And that is from some conservative leaders who have very vigorously spoken up against the Bush administration's effort to go to war against Iraq. That's an odd exception that we might want to play with a little more.
We've got to take a break. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight about the American character in wartime. What face of the American character is the war on terror revealing to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University,
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the American character in wartime. Our guests are David Kennedy, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, 1929 to 1945, and Michael Sherry, Associate Dean of History at Northwestern University and author of In the Shadow of War, the United States since the 1930s. The question is, does it change the equation of our understanding of war and our own character when the homeland itself is threatened, has been hit, is vulnerable? Is the American wartime character fogging our view of this conflict or helping us see through to its core? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ruth is on the line. Hi, Ruth. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a kind of a two-part question. I'm representing the under 25 listeners, I guess.
Good to hear from you.
And as a student overseas, when this all occurred, I remember for the first 2 weeks there was a continuously running CNN broadcast and everyone was glued to the set. And then after a few weeks, there weren't really any more people watching, and then they took the TV out of the room that it was in.
War or no war, they were done with that.
Exactly. So I guess my question was whether your guests have noticed a similar reaction in that, one, at least initially, the youth, I guess, were sort of shocked out of their false sense of security, and two, they have, at least from my own experience, they've sort of quickly lulled themselves back into that sense of security and what the ramifications for that might be in the future if we have a whole generation who doesn't really know what real war could be and they're not really interested in it.
Ruth, we'll turn to our guest. Thanks so much for your call. David Kennedy, what about it? There's a lesson here for a generation of Americans. Does it overwhelm the lessons of history to see this kind of war called and wait for it all to be fleshed out?
Well, Ruth's question, in a way, goes back to John's question or point earlier about how any notion of sacrifice seems to be missing from the current discussion of this matter. I agree with Michael Sherry that there was a great initial sacrifice a year ago. But we might ask, if the president today asked for a sacrifice, what form would it take? What exactly would it be required for us to do in order to feel a sense of commitment and sacrifice and dedication to this matter? We have now acquired a military capacity of such a nature that it can be deployed, as I said earlier, without much disruption of domestic life. So in a sense, oddly enough, the notion of sacrifice is in some ways has become obsolete given the nature of the kind of warfare we're now capable of inflicting. Ruth mentioned she was overseas on 9/11/01. As it happened, I spent about a month in Australia beginning about a week after that, at the end of September and most of October of last year. And I was surprised there. I think of Australia as a sister society. It has a very similar history, another settler society with British origins and so on. Australians and Americans, I think, on an individual level, always get along quite famously with each other.
And last fall?
Last fall, it surprised me considerably how much anti-Americanism I encountered there, even in the almost immediate aftermath.
Why? What was the root?
Well, a lot of it took the form of the kind of the subtext of a lot of questions that I got was, well, I guess you arrogant SOBs got your comeuppance at last. And it reminded me, or it, I shouldn't say reminded me because it surprised me, but it underlined for me how much kind of visceral anti-American sentiment is out there, even amongst peoples who are otherwise, I think, psychologically and morally quite sympathetic to us.
We may be longing for innocence, but we're not necessarily seen as innocent. Peter's on the line. Welcome, Peter. You're on the air.
I wanted to discuss the great absence in the middle, which I think has to do with American character and certainly American schooling, which is inattention to ideas, to ideology, as if these things do not matter. American schools tend not to have required courses in philosophy, unlike schools in Europe, and there is an inhibition for various reasons, but in discussing the ideology that underlies this particular conflict.
Peter, are you suggesting that Americans are somehow so little learned in their own political philosophy that they're not prepared to go to battle for it now?
No, that's not what I'm suggesting at all.
What
I'm suggesting is that although it is certainly true that people do lack knowledge of history that could once be assumed, I'm saying that there is an inattention to the fact that ideas matter. And the ideas that were in the heads of the people who now oppose us can be identified, can be studied, are available in the Quran and the Hadith. And because we are both mesmerized and terrified, I suppose, or deeply respectful of the very word religion, we refuse to confront the elements of a particular religion that have nothing to do with private worship.
Peter, let me put that to Michael Sherry, if I may. Michael Sherry, I guess the thing I'll pick out of that is this notion of the power of ideas. Is it possible that we're missing an opportunity to push back at the ideological or thought level and instead itching for the trigger?
Well, the comment is sort of so global about American education that it's a little hard for me to get hold of it at that level. But what it suggests to me, or what it reminds me of, is I hope this doesn't sound callous to what's going on, but the extraordinary kind of navel-gazing quality of American thinking, or at least American media coverage.
As opposed to what that you'd like to see now?
Not really very much seen about what is going on elsewhere in the world, how we interact with the rest of the world.
It's all about us, even when we're in a fight with something else.
It's about us and our loss.
Let's try and get one more call. Paul's on the line. Welcome, Paul. You're on the air.
I would like to speak to the issue of character as it relates to U.S. leadership, specifically in Washington. And follow me along very quickly. I don't think this is so idiosyncratic. I see what has been going on with President Bush and his colleagues is a kind of combination of unfulfilled fantasy with a psychoanalytic impulse. And what I mean by that is that President Bush, by being arrogant, is perhaps fulfilling a vision of victory based on a moral right, which is one of the greatest fantasies of a political leader if he can't broker a peace on the planet. And I think that's driving him, together with finishing what his father, who was also a president of the United States, started, and that's making him arrogant and first rattling the saber and not going to the U.N.
Paul, our time is almost up, but let me put it to David Kennedy. David Kennedy, is somehow the world today so complex that the urge to war is irresistible as a solution?
Well, I'm not sure I can answer that with clarity. I will say that what we regard as our own righteous innocence in this country and the affection that so many of us have for this great and good country is easily understood out there in the rest of the world as a smug and self-contented kind of arrogance. So I think to that extent, Paul's absolutely right, that our own self-regard may not be consonant with the way the rest of the world sees us. I dare say, going back to Peter's comment earlier, your previous caller, mm-hmm. who mentioned the Quran and the Hadith, mm-hmm. I doubt if a year ago 1% of the people in this country had ever heard of the Hadith. So we have begun, I think, to a certain extent, to learn something about those forces out there in the world that don't see things exactly as we do, but we've got a long way to go.
David Kennedy, Michael Sherry, our time is too short. I hope we can talk again. Thank you so much to you both for being with us tonight. David Kennedy, you're welcome. David Kennedy is professor of history at Stanford University and author of Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War. Michael Sherry is associate dean of history at Northwestern University and author of In the Shadow of War, The United States Since the 1930s. Jack, thanks for being with us. Coming up, a man who helped build the Twin Towers 30 years ago tells us what it was like clearing their rubble. This is On Point. Early in Joe Bradley's construction career, he helped build what were, for a time, the tallest buildings in human history, the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center. On September 12, 2001, the crane operator was called to take part in the almost unimaginable task of untangling and removing the pieces of the vast wreckage of those towers 3 decades after he helped put them up. The almost sacramental dedication of the blue-collar crews that worked at Ground Zero has entered into the realm of American legend. In this radio diary, crane operator Joe Bradley reflects on a career bookended by history and how the past year has forever altered the meaning of his work.
Well, when I was a younger guy, I was a laborer when I first came in, and I was just a little piece of what was going on. I remember talking to my brother, and he was in Vietnam, and I told him that I was working on the biggest job in the world in New York City. It was a thrill. And I don't ever think that I'll be the same. I'll never look at a job exactly the same way as I looked at him before. The 10 months that it took to straighten things out down here was a very emotional ride, and I was fortunate that I was able to get through it. I was fortunate that I was called to come down here. Construction people never had really a very good reputation in the city of New York. We make noise, we close streets. Nobody ever wants to build anything more than what was built here before. There's a lot of people that are opposed to construction, basically. Well, after September 11th, people realized what we did and what we were doing, and there's probably no one on earth except for the building trades to take care of this job. You know, all the firefighters and policemen and soldiers that were down here, they kind of relied on us to move the material. So it was the operating engineers and the iron workers, the teamsters and the laborers, and it was a terrific group of people because they were unsupervised initially, and everybody really kind of knew what they had to do. You know, we didn't have to worry about being told to go to lunch or coffee breaks. Everybody worked as a team, and it was a great spirit of cooperation. And then the public, never before, I walked down Broadway to go to the train, and people would say good morning and smile, and we would walk out of Ground Zero, and there were kids with bandstands, and they would cheer for you. That was extremely emotional that they were cheering. I turned around the first time to see who they were cheering for. It was quite a thrill, and there were a lot of tears. My father's generation pulled this country together with Pearl Harbor, and they got just ordinary people to do extraordinary things. And I thought that, wow, that could never happen again. You could never get the American public to join together the way they did in 1941. And I saw this happen, and I found out that I was naive, that Americans are wonderful, wonderful people. The things that were sent down here, children's cards and letters and supplies and socks and underwear, toothpaste, razor kits, clothing, boots, everything that we need was sent by the public. I mean, it was absolutely unbelievable. The outpouring of generosity, the spirit of cooperation amongst everyone. So I was naive, thinking that in the days of the internet and television and that people wouldn't join together like they did. This was a tremendous effort, and it was done in half the time with half the money and no real serious injuries. So there was kind of a miracle. I think that all the spirit and those that were lost and that were victims of the terrorists, I think they kind of stayed here and helped us with everything. And that's why I think nobody really got hurt. I mean, I know for a fact that things that happened, accidents that occurred, we had machines fall through 2-3 floors, and the operator was at coffee. I walked through Building 6, and there were holes, and when I walked back, I just couldn't understand how I didn't fall through one of the holes, you know, that I had never even seen. So I think that the spirits that died here kind of helped us with everything. They kind of steered us and kept us safe. I want to be down here till I finish my career. I'm 57 years old, and I'd like to stay here until it's over.
Joe Bradley is a backhoe and crane operator from Valley Stream, New York. He's a member of Operating Engineers Local 15. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.